This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
I'm Dave Kattenberg, and this is 12 Canadians Building a Better World from the Inside Out.
So about 11 years ago, I was asked to be acting head of the Department of Pediatrics and Child Health, which is a very famous department. It has, the first head was Dr. Bruce Chown, who was very famous for developing R8. Harry Medavy, who was very famous. He's the guy that gave me my first job. Vic Chernick, who's a very famous pediatric respirologist. I think I paid him to work here. You know, that the times have changed in terms of entitlement. And then Jim Howarth was a colleague of mine. The only previous former female department head was Aggie Bishop. And Brian Postal, you must know the name.
I know the name.
He's an incredible, incredible leader. He's now Dean of Medicine. And I succeeded Michael Moffat. And here's my spot, I guess.
Right in the corner.
In the corner. So I've been at this for 11 years now. All work and no play makes mom a dull person. This is easy. So my name is Cheryl Rockman Greenberg. So I'm a medical doctor, and I trained in medicine and in pediatrics at McGill University. And at some point in my undergraduate medical education, my undergraduate education at McGill, I, you know, had the privilege of being exposed to several whom I think were brilliant scientists. And when I sat in their class and uncertain what I wanted to do in my life, I said to myself, you know, I want to do that. You know, there's always one person or two people whom can become your mentors, who you want to become like that, you know. I was looking for something that I knew I was interested in science. I knew I liked genetics, and I said I wanted to do that. These are people who really combined tremendous humanity and an empathy and a care for people with a passion for science. And by no means do I ever consider myself in their category, but they became my mentors. They really shaped everything I did in my professional life. So I trained in pediatrics, because in those days you needed to become a pediatrician before you could, let's say, subspecialize in genetic diseases. I was always interested in genetics because to me it really combined family medicine, albeit of a specialized nature, with academic curiosity and academic pursuits, which I was always interested in. So it, to me, was a win-win situation to be able to combine clinical medicine and research using, you know, in the field of genetics. I joined the Children's Hospital and Department of Pediatrics and Child Health in 1979, and I was a clinical geneticist. In other words, I dealt with children and families where there were clinical concerns that the problems that the children had might have a genetic or a metabolic basis. By metabolic, I mean that there's a hereditary basis from a metabolic point of view and how the body is making energy from protein, carbohydrates, or fat. And these are very rare hereditary metabolic diseases. So I started to work through the Department of Pediatrics in genetics and metabolism. And it was really pretty much clinical work. And about 1983, so I was here for 4 years, the former head of genetics at the time, Dr. John Hamerton, who I enormously respected, you know, he sat me down one day and he said, you know, Cheryl, have you ever thought about developing more of a formal research career? And I said, I hadn't really thought of it. I was so busy working and seeing patients and doing what I enjoyed. In my days, you know, you trained, you loved what you did, and you went to work. But John Hamerton, I had tremendous respect for, he said, why don't you get some formal training in, you know, some of the up-and-coming areas of genetics research. And I did a 2-year fellowship in molecular genetics in John Hamerton's lab, where I learned what DNA is, how you study it. And I began to use DNA technology to answer important questions about what is the basis for some of the genetic disorders that are overrepresented here in Manitoba. But in those days, a lot of the DNA testing that we did, it would take a week to isolate the DNA, to study it, and to come up with, you know, even an answer for a basic experiment. Where now, with very high throughput DNA sequencers, you can probably get the same results in an hour. What would have taken me in the 80s, a week. So that's how, you know, the magnitude of the technology has changed. From a public health point of view, from a government point of view in planning resources, the thing that causes probably the most impact on utilizing healthcare dollars are common disorders that are called multifactorial, where the basis for them are a combination of genetic factors as well as environmental factors. Diabetes, type 2 diabetes, it has a genetic predisposition, but a lot of it has to do with lifestyle. You have hypertension. These are what are called multifactorial disorders or polygenic disorders. Many genes contributing to what your genetic blueprint is in terms of a predisposition to a common disease, such as hypertension, such as diabetes, but you have to have some environmental trigger that brings it out. Hence all the emphasis on lifestyle, weight reduction, you know, salt intake, exercise, lifestyle choices, smoking, you know. So from a government point of view and health planning point of view, governments are perhaps most interested in making an impact on common diseases because it affects the vast majority of populations. I myself have always been focused on rare diseases, the single gene disorders that are rare in the general population. They may be overrepresented in some of our unique populations, but they're still rare in the general population. You know, there is a background frequency of genetic disorders that you see throughout the population. 2 to 3% of all babies are born with, you know, a congenital malformation, that a developmental abnormality in how part of the body would form. So there's a basal rate always. Over and above that, there are certain single gene disorders that are seen throughout Canada. For example, cystic fibrosis, which is a single gene. If we have 30,000 pairs of genes in our genome, one pair of genes, everybody has two copies of every gene, there is a mutation in one particular gene called the CFTR gene that causes cystic fibrosis. Now, in that gene called the CFTR gene, there's more than 1,000 different mutations, changes in the misprints in that gene that have been described that lead to a change in the function of the gene and lead to what we see as cystic fibrosis. And in Manitoba, we have several populations who are culturally very distinct. And when you celebrate, you know, the richness of some unique cultures, it sometimes comes with a little price of the genetic disorders that sometimes become overrepresented or at higher frequency. So within the general Caucasian populations, we will see certain conditions that are overrepresented. Probably cystic fibrosis is the most common one. But in some of our other, you know, culturally identified populations, such as Hutterite or people of Mennonite descent, or our Aboriginal populations, we see many recessive disorders that are overrepresented. In this day and age, in our very rich country, in a very privileged country, nobody should be denied treatment on the basis of where they're born. You know, everybody should have equal access to all the advances in medicine. If you can extrapolate from that, if you believe about equity and access to care, then the corollary to that is just because you have a rare disease, you shouldn't be penalized just because you have a rare disease. It's by no choice that you've asked to have a rare disease, but you know, you should have the same access to research advances, clinical care, as if you have a common disease, such as cancer. And that really is what's driving me. I've always had a passion to try to speak for people who have rare diseases, who have no idea where to turn, who cannot identify with other people with other diseases because their experiences are so different. You know, my job as a physician, and in this case, I'm speaking purely as a geneticist, is to help speak for those patients and families and rare disorders and advocate for them in terms of not just advocate for research on their disorders, but advocate on access to treatments. I have maybe 24 children and adults with very rare metabolic diseases caused by very rare enzyme deficiencies that are now amenable to treatment. And these treatments have been developed in collaboration between basic scientists, clinicians such as myself, pharma, and we have to find a way to develop clinical trials in collaboration with industry or investigator-initiated that will prove benefit of these treatments. And how are we going to come up with a rational framework to be able to afford these medications and often offer people who have very rare diseases the same access to treatments in Canada as people such as who have cancer? So in my role as a physician, over the past 3.5 decades I've been as physicians, I've moved really from being a pure clinician in increasing my knowledge base, you know, to working in administration and working in advocacy. And realizing as physicians we have responsibilities not just to take care of patients, not just to research, but to close the loop and translate those researches into practical advances and practical access for patients, and often patients who really cannot speak for themselves. For many people, it's been a lifelong journey for families to try to find exactly what you call the condition that the child had. Because by telling what a diagnosis is, it also eliminates all the demons that you might be carrying as, you know, did I do anything in pregnancy to cause this? By having a precise diagnosis, it eliminates a lot of the second guessing that families go through when they have a child born with an unexpected collection of problems. If we have children with undiagnosed genetic or metabolic syndromes that we feel are likely single gene, probably whether it's a dominant gene or a recessive gene, the ability to make a diagnosis through whole exome sequencing or rapid throughput sequencing using the modern technology of Forge and Phenome Central will allow us to be very precise, not just what the diagnosis is, but what is the pattern of inheritance, whether it's recessive or whether it's dominant. And this is very important information to share with people. Genetic research allows us to, with modern technology and projects such as Forge, to make precise diagnosis, establish with certainty patterns of inheritance, precisely counsel families as to what it is and the corollary, what it isn't. The next step is by having precise diagnoses, we really enable the families in order to access services for their children, because nowadays, in order to access all the services you need for special education, et cetera, you need to have a diagnosis. There are many families with children with undiagnosed conditions who can't access services because they need a diagnosis. So having a diagnosis tremendously enhances their abilities to advocate for their children and for us to advocate on their behalf as well. Where we're still, for many of these genetic syndromes, light years away perhaps, is treatment, being able to change the natural history of the disease. But when we think of the advances and the progress that we've made over the past 50 years, one can't even begin to speculate what these disorders might look like from a therapeutic point of view 50 years from now. So it gives, although we have no specific treatments now, it certainly gives hope for the future, where hope for some families never existed before. And it empowers the families by having diagnoses, by knowing what it isn't, by knowing what it is, and being able to take that next step and plan forward, move forward and plan for their children. So my name is Cheryl Rockman-Greenberg, and I'm a medical doctor. I'm a genetic specialist who specializes in the diagnosis and treatment and advocacy for children and adults with rare metabolic genetic disorders. That's my main professional life as a subspecialist. Another big part of what I do, which I think has enhanced my ability to be a doctor, has been in medical administration. As head of the Department of Pediatrics and Child Health at the University of Manitoba and medical director for the Child Health Program in the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority. And I always like to spin things very positively, but you know, there are families where we do make diagnoses after many years. And some of those families don't do well when you actually give them a diagnosis. Because when you give them a diagnosis, you've kind of told them that it's not going to get better. And you've, sometimes for some families, they have taken that as a way of not so much losing hope, but as long as you don't have a diagnosis, there's always a small chance that they're going to wake up one day and all this is going to go away and their kids are going to be fine.
But a diagnosis, sometimes they open doors, but often they close doors.
Exactly. So there are families where we have to continue to support them when they have found that we have closed the door on them. And that's never our intention. But, you know, we think, you know, as medical doctors, we're obsessed with making diagnoses. But for some families, having a diagnosis isn't as important as for other families. Like, for example, like we have children that we follow with many different problems where we recommend continued investigations. New technologies have come. Do you want to participate in Forge? And you know something? People sometimes say no. If it's not likely to be able to cure my child or really change a natural history, then we have to at some point stop and just learn and accept and move forward with what we have. So there are many families who would choose not to participate in brilliant studies such as Forge, Phenome Central, or Care for Rare, but that's an individual choice, and I respect that. And so do all my colleagues and people who lead these organizations. Many families will develop these partnerships with us and move forward in diagnosis and research and treatment advances. But for some families, they just want to get on with their lives. They'll come back to see us every year and they'll keep in touch, but they won't get as actively involved or keep searching, you know, for that elusive answer. And everybody's different, you know, and as a professional, you just have to respect that no two people are going to think the same about the same problem. And that's all part of being a professional as well. Learn, you know, you present the information as objective as you can, but people's responses, you can't necessarily predict how people will respond. And some people will accept, and some people, you know, will choose, you know, thank you very much, I'll come and see you every year, but we're just going to get on with our lives. The work that I've done with respect to translational medicine and translating research advances into advances in treatment for children have been in a variety of hereditary metabolic diseases that have been overrepresented in certain of our Manitoba populations. One is CPT1 deficiency in our Hutterite population, which is a rare metabolic disorder of how fat is metabolized to energy. And through our understanding and identification of the cause of this rare recessive condition, we've been able to develop newborn screening programs that have identified children who are at risk for this disorder and implements treatments so they don't get sick with the disease.
That's an enzyme deficiency?
It's an enzyme deficiency. So a lot of my work at the research level in identifying the metabolic and molecular basis for rare diseases in Manitoba's unique populations have translated into newborn screening programs where we can identify affected children and begin treatment early. Also, they've been translated into development of new clinical treatments, and I've been involved in the clinical trials of a variety of enzymes who have been developed through enzyme technology, through recombinant enzymes that have been made when these deficiencies have been identified, and we find out the cause of these disorders. Many of our patients are now candidates to take part in clinical trials of enzyme replacement therapy for rare metabolic diseases. And these treatments, it started at the research level, at the bedside, identifying families with the disorders, finding the metabolic cause, and now going back to families and offering them participation in clinical trials for enzyme replacement therapy, replacing the missing enzyme, and absolutely changing the natural history of these diseases. And this has been the most satisfying one of late for me has been hypophosphatasia, which is a metabolic bone disease.
Not enough phosphatase.
Not enough alkaline phosphatase. And that's the enzyme that allows calcium and phosphate to precipitate in bone. So we have a rare metabolic bone disease called hypophosphatasia, where the skeleton is completely undermineralized. And now with enzyme replacement therapy, it's still in clinical trial phase, just, you know, still have approval for licensure. But it has the potential, based on early results of clinical trials, of transforming a completely untreatable disease into a treatable one.
So taking an enzyme and formulating it into a capsule or a pill of some sort?
Most of the enzyme replacement therapy has to be given IV or subcutaneously, because if you give it orally, they haven't been able to encapsulate it such that it's still broken down by the stomach acid. So they're given IV, often on home treatment programs, every 2 weeks given IV or like subcutaneously under the skin like an insulin injection. You know, and replacing the enzyme. The technology is fantastic because it's one thing for a researcher to develop the enzyme in a laboratory setting. It's the other thing is to scale it up at a production level of industry grade, human grade enzyme that you actually can give to patients and actually get the enzyme to go where it's supposed to go, to do its job, to stay there, and to have its effects sustained.
And for the round of treatment not to cost $1 million.
Well, the problem is it does cost $1 million. And therein lies the rub. And that's where I wear my administrative hat to work on behalf of families with government and industry and parent support groups to develop some kind of a rational approach to how our rare drugs or drugs for rare metabolic disease going to be reimbursed in this country. Do we reimburse them just like we do every cancer drug? And why not? Why do people who have rare metabolic diseases, why should they be penalized just because they have a rare metabolic disease? You know, the answer is somewhere in between. These drugs are enormously expensive. I mean, drug development for an orphan disease, a rare metabolic disease, the costs are enormous. But there has to be some kind of national framework for how we're going to approach, you know, the licensure and the development of drugs. And then at the provincial level, we have to develop and advocate for rational reimbursement strategies so everybody will have access to treatments for rare metabolic diseases. And it doesn't depend where you live. It doesn't depend how much money you have. You have to be driven by the same fundamental principle that everybody deserves equal access to advances in treatment, regardless of how rare their disease is and regardless of where they live. And that's the mantra that I live by, and that's what I try to translate ultimately back to the care of patients. It is my life, you know, and I think you see that you pay a price on a personal level, you know, that, you know, I have worked very hard. I have been driven by it, but I've also felt it's an absolute responsibility. And what drives me are truly the fact that I know the sacrifice that my parents made so I could go to university. And I speak this because the newer generation doesn't think like this. I know it doesn't. But my parents were very bright. They never went to university. They were first-generation Canadians. They were born here, first-generation Canadians. They died very young, when I was a teenager. And all I remember from them is, you know, that I had to honor their memory because they sacrificed so much so that my brothers and I mean, my mom died before Medicare, and I know the sacrifices that the family made, you know, and she died much too young. She was 41. And what drives me really is that it's been such a privilege to have the opportunity to do what I do. And I've never taken it lightly. And it's just an absolute responsibility that I have to do what I do, because if I don't do it, then all the investment that's been made in me through university, medical school, the sacrifices that people have given so I can get here, then, you know, it, to me, it would be totally irresponsible if I didn't pay back in some way. People pay back in different ways. My only way I can pay back is doing what I know how to do, and that's just to be a doctor. And that's all I really have wanted to do my entire professional life. It's hard for me because I'm at that age in my life where I realize that 95% of my career is behind me. And that's a hard thing to face. But I do it with a great deal of satisfaction, not just because I feel that, you know, we've been able to make changes that have helped improve the quality of life of many patients. But I also know that the trainees who are coming up will carry on the work, because it's all about the patient. To me, it's all about the patient. And that, you know, if there's one message that I can give, is that remember that, you know, we have an obligation. You know, people have invested in us, and we have an obligation to give back to the patient. And to me, the most satisfying part of the job is that when you've made that small difference, you know, to patient life, that's enough for me, you know. And it's not helping hundreds of thousands of people, but an N equal one help is good for me too.
You've been listening to 12 Canadians Building a Better World from the Inside Out. Huge thanks to the Social Justice Fund of the Canadian Auto Workers Union for their generous support. 12 Canadians is created by Earth Chronicle Productions, Winnipeg, Canada. I'm Dave Kattenberg. Bye for now.